Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And welcome to The Food Fight, where we offer a different perspective on food culture issues around Australia and the world.
We'll talk with chefs, producers, business owners and experts to hear their stories and find out what makes them tick.
This episode we chat with Victor Leong from Chukka and Li Ho Fook about his move away from fine dining to embracing his Chinese roots and about the evolution of Chinese food in the Australian dining landscape. Right, welcome to another episode of the Food Fight podcast. My name is Steph Postuma. Thank you so much for joining us. Of course, joined by partner in crime, Simon Evans, chef and a hospitality guru from Wales.
They're getting good.
To start our podcast, we'd like to do an acknowledgement of country. So being here in Melbourne, we'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which we gather and speak today, and pay respect to elders past, present, and emerging. All right, let's introduce our guest, Simon. We're here with Victor Leong at Li Ho Fook here in Melbourne. Mate, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yeah, it's really good to be here, and it's really good to get down here. But look, to start with, we were just talking about this before we started the podcast, that we're not going to go into a chef's life story because we do try to avoid that, and you've done a bunch of podcasts. You got another one this arvo as well, so we're not going to bore you. But how's, like, you know, give us a brief wrap of like how things are going at the moment. You know, feeling optimistic, feeling tired.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of all of that, right? So it's we're definitely in that re-emerging stage of, you know, everything that's happened last year. We've changed our offering here at Li Ho Fook, you know, moving forward, and I'm optimistic about, you know, what we can kind of move forward on. And I think I've been thinking about this a lot, you know, even before the change, is how do you, you know, kind of evolve a restaurant? Like, what forces you to change, you know, what? And it feels like, well, this is the time. Like, if it's not going to, you know, get closer to what we are trying to achieve, you know, in the long term, then when is it, you know? So I think using this as like a, you know, a reset, and moving the business and the offering forward has been, yeah, it's been quite fun.
Okay. Was that something you sort of had in mind or like had on the cards before COVID? Was like a little evolution, a little rethink?
Yeah, I think, you know, every brand, restaurants, you know, even person goes through a little bit of a change. And I've always wanted to kind of focus what we're trying to, you know, communicate a little bit even before, and with, you know, I think even sensibilities in myself and you know, the style of food I want to cook and the creativity I want to kind of bring forward, it's nice to kind of, you know, finally just go settle into this style and go, okay, this is what we're going to try and explore, and then we kind of, you know, refine that, and then we, you know, get an opportunity to present it. And now it's, you know, what you're working on the project, you know, it's real time now instead of just kind of conceptually in your head. So it's good. A lot of fun. So I am tired.
What does it look like? Like what?
Yeah. Did you guys change from sort of a la carte to just tasting?
Or yeah, correct. So we used to have a wide kind of range of offerings, you know, in quite a small restaurant. So downstairs used to be a cocktail bar where you could get some snacks that was different to what's upstairs. And that was, you know, quite an extensive menu of a la carte offerings, you know, mostly shared offerings with a banquet for larger tables, just kind of showcase a range of, you know, menu items. But yeah, I think since reopening last November, we're now doing just a tasting menu, so like a menu degustation. It's 8 courses at dinner time and 4 courses at lunchtime. And that's just come from, obviously, you know, you have just better control of your costs and, you know, the outgoings and, you know, you can forecast better. And I didn't have, I lost almost 50% of my staff. So, you know, you can operate, you know, almost a little bit kind of with more focus, I guess, you know. And we haven't, we only open 4 days a week at the moment. And, you know, the team's small. I've only got a core team of 7 people. You know, like, down from, you know, I think up to 18 at peak before. So
it's interesting that everyone kind of, a lot of people going away from tasting menus pre-COVID, and now everyone's kind of going back to them. And I think it's just because there is a reason that they work for the restaurant, maybe less so for the guests in some ways, but for the restaurant, it's so much easier to work out what I need to order, how many staff I need, you know, how many we're going to do, you know, to the portion. Like Kavo, we had so little waste at Kavo because we'd just you know, order in the right amount and then use it. Like it was just so absolutely waste.
And also I think it's funny because I think before all of this it was you were just wanting to have an accessible product that you people could use in any kind of form. But then, you know, kind of towards, like, you'd still be frustrated with the, you know, like the lower head spend or the people that, you know, still would complain about the lack of offering or, you know what I mean? It's like, so you, if like changing to a tasting menu format, it gives us the opportunity to A, tell the story on our terms. So we go, hey, this is what we think you should be eating in this season, you know, in our style for now. And it tells a story completely end to end. So there isn't like, oh, hey, you know, I went to Liho Fook and the food was really, like, really like sweet or really salty or really oily. But then it's, we left that control to you and you just decided to order everything from the deep fryer. You know what I mean? Like, don't make it my problem. So now if, you know, there's any kind of feedback on the menu, we really, you know, we look at it and go, oh, maybe we did misjudge that, or, you know what I mean? Like,
that's really interesting. And I guess it's something that I hadn't thought about too much, but you see it, like, I mean, there's tasting menus, 8 courses, and then you've got your, you know, Noma 25 course geranium, like crazy things. And like, that's a place where you, if you're not conscious of how each course is going to affect the palate of the diner, then you'll drown and have, I'm assuming, a lot of bad feedback. But at the other point, like you say, Victor, it's a great opportunity to be able to convey so much more than just food and a good night out through your food. Like, you can tell a story and really showcase your identity as a restaurant every step of the way.
Yeah, 100%. And that's, you know, and I think I probably don't love working like this. Like, not working like this. I don't really love, like, cooking like this. It's kind of too methodical and too process-driven. I really do enjoy, like, just, you know, kind of cooking a little bit more instinctively. But then I really do enjoy working like this, you know, when everything's measured and controlled and, you know, everybody's, you know, kind of, it's working kind of together as a team, delivering something on time, precisely. All these things are really appealing to me.
Yeah, I mean, down to like the timings you have between dishes, and you know, like, right, I've just sent that for, I'll send this one, then I'll get their other thing on. Like, it's not even like your timings are set out for the whole night when you've got a tasting menu, which, like, consistency and control, which a lot of chefs
We love that. But then also, I do miss, you know, throwing a walk around for 2 hours and getting a sore arm and, you know what I mean? Like, cooking stuff on the fly, which is, you know, one of the reasons why I think, you know, they have all kind of settled into, you know, this kind of creative, kind of wacky, kooky, kind of, you know, fast-paced type dining restaurants. And it's interesting to see it evolve into, you know, what we are now. So
how did the customers respond to that change? Like, is it hard to sort of bring them along from, like you say, like, fast paced, what's getting thrown around on the fly a bit more and instinctive, to, all right, when you come here, you are here for the full experience?
Yeah, look, you know, you're not going to make anyone happy, like, all the time, right? So I think, unfortunately, we have probably, you know, we've lost some of the customers. But then also, I think it's also, they're considering it now. It's like, okay, great, you know, I can't come here like how I used to and sit down and have a glass of wine and, you know, order the eggplant. But, you know, on a slightly more, you know, special occasion, or, you know, when they have a little bit more time, they'll consider us as a dining option. You know, so for me, it's, you know, it's... you can't, if even if I opened day one as a degustation menu restaurant, I'd still encounter the same problems, right? Yeah. You know, and you know, if all of a sudden I turned from a tasting menu to an a la carte restaurant, I'd encounter the same problems as well, because they'd be like, oh, we used to like your tasting menu, you know, like, so you can't win them all.
Yeah. I think that's what's happened. Like, hospitality has been very hospitable over the years, and we've tried to cover all bases. Cover all bases, give everyone what they want and to any request. And I think what I like about COVID, the small bits I like about it, is that we've decided that we're going to dictate terms a bit more. Yeah. So whether it's, you know, taking payment before booking, which
just
should have been done for
so
many
years. But it's
all
these things, right? You know, like, you can accept that you pay for a flight before you go, right? Yeah. You can also accept that if you're 10 minutes late to the boarding gate, you miss the flight,
yeah,
right? Despite paying for this. You know what I mean? Like, you can accept the fact that once the movie's finished, you leave the cinema. You know what I mean? Like, all these things you can accept in, you know, in other kind of service, experiential, you know, industries. But then when people come to restaurants or cafes, they think that, oh, what do you mean? I'm paying for the $35 dish that you put out. Why can't I stay for 3 hours?
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know, mate.
I love comparing hospitality to the airline industry. Because you're like, what if we like overbooked the restaurant and someone wrote up like, sorry, we overbooked, we thought someone would cancel, like, which is would be a legitimate thing to do with the amount of cancellations you get. Imagine we did that, we'd fucking uproar.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
it'd be correct, wild.
But, you know, like, and that's exactly it, you know? So
even charge more for the best seats. Yeah. Like, imagine you did that as a restaurant.
How good at that?
Do you know what I mean?
Like,
I mean, not the cafe, we had the best seats. It was like, you could watch Kira Street and watch some drunk people go by, or you can sit near the bar. Was it?
Yeah.
Very much an option.
Let's change direction a little bit, because, you know, there's so much we can be talking about in a short amount of time, Victor. But I think, like, coming through in everything we read or hear when you sort of participate in the media is culture, is that line, because... It's not like, I mean, it's evident here. You opened Lee Ho Fook to go back to your roots and do what you wanted to do, a move away from the fine dining world that you were in. But did you always have a really deep interest in both culture in general and your own heritage and your own culture?
Yeah, look, you know, when I first opened Lee Ho Fook, it was just to kind of have a bit of creative expression on, you know, a style of restaurant that I wanted to open. You know, I was 27 at the time. You know, and where you are 8 years ago is completely different to what you kind of, you know, are today. And yeah, it was great fun, because I wanted to kind of be really creative and kind of strip back the formalities of, you know, my kind of training and explore a little bit of like cultural heritage that I felt like I missed out doing, you know, when I was kind of in my early teens and kind of early 20s as well, you know. So kind of revisiting the idea of what Chinese food is and where it sits in this Australian kind of, you know, cultural scene, right? Like food, art, you know, city, whatever it was, right? And, you know, having the opportunity to open it on Smith Street in Collingwood in Melbourne, which is kind of like... Oh, it's like King Street, Newtown, right? You know, it's got, you know, something for everyone. You know, it's got very established, businesses, and kind of really new. You know, it's not really a morning scene, because, you know, everyone's just out drinking and partying and eating and having a great time. And it's not far from the city. So, you know, being kind of immersed in that in the first couple of years was really kind of cool, because it was... And then from there, you know, other kind of more... established businesses kind of established around that time, which is with like Morgan from Bell's moved around the corner, you know, Cutler was always there, you know, the Builder's Arms was kind of developing, you know, now it's even more vibrant. So it was really cool. And a big part of, building Lee Ho Fook as a brand, a restaurant, a project for myself was to, you know, explore like a cultural heritage and the food of, you know, of China and where it is in kind of an Australian lens, you know. And I think as that's developed, you know, it's everything helps you kind of dictate, you know, where to go. I think it's the customer, it's the staff, it's, you know, the influences and the inspirations that, you know, kind of come to me. And yeah, I think we've arrived here in a quite an organic manner, you know what I mean? So
But was it something you always envisioned doing, or was it almost a sort of backlash to the kind of French European centric fine dining restaurants you were working in?
Yeah, it's tricky, right? Because when I first started cooking, it was all about like, hey, just build your CV.
Yeah,
right? And
yeah.
I made a decision to cook fine dining, and I you know, did a bit of a research and restaurants I wanted to cook in, and you know, ended up at Mark, and that was really appealing because it was a small team, you know, owner operated, just good timing. He, you know, he got all the accolades when I kind of joined, so I got, you know, almost the peak, you know, the start of like the peak of, you know, Mark Best's kind of you know,
like awesome team
time there.
He had there,
and
for most
it was awesome. And so, and from that, you know, I made a. You go through a little bit of a soul searching process after you get all the, what you consider you get all the skills from, you know, one place. And I felt that I needed to explore the idea of cooking Asian food because I haven't, you know, up to that point.
Mm.
So
where did you start? Like, you know, as you said, like you hadn't been cooking Asian food. Like, have you always read books? Have you always studied history?
Yeah, I think I was always a, you know, avid reader and studying history of, you know, all sorts of things. And I think like food history is naturally going to be interesting, right? But I think timing, I was very lucky with timing, and also Sydney was very lucky to have Dan Hong, you know, who was the guy that, you know, I think once everything is... The importance of Dan Hong is probably understated at the moment. I think as in a generation and a half time, everyone will realize how influential he is, you know, and the amount of kind of work that he's done to kind of, you know, for chefs like me to have the things I have, you know what I mean? Like, so yeah, I think the first step was I worked for Dan, and we all worked together at Miss G's, planning to open Mr. Wong's. And I remember going into that kitchen and everyone was of Asian descent, everybody.
Yeah, well.
You know what I mean? And everyone was around my age. Everyone had previous Eurocentric fine dining experience, except for one or two. But everyone was like just keen to learn. And obviously, when you work in a kitchen like that, you know, in any kitchen, really, you learn the food of the chef. And while you're doing that, you still learn from the guy that's left of you, right of you, above you, below you, right? And, you know, having... you know, young Vietnamese Australian chefs, you know, young Thai chefs, you know, Filipino, you know, Zhao, the head chef, was Taiwanese, Hongi's, you know, Vietnamese, Australian, and you just get this huge,
yeah, it must have been quite,
know,
a
like
kind of
absorption of everyone's kind of creative angst and like, you know, like experience with that, their style of food, you know, and it shows through all the times that you have an opportunity to be creative, which is first up staff meals, so you eat amazing staff meals, sure. You know what I mean, and everyone, because everyone's like, at the time I was probably 25 26, you know what I mean, and everyone had a lot of energy, and you know, to go out and eat out, and we'd talk just food, and it was really cool to see, you know, that there was a whole almost generation of chefs exactly like me, you know what I mean, like Asian Australian, and kind of at the crossroad of, do I keep going down the path of cooking at, you know, like a two hat French place, or do I, you know, have a dabble and have a look at what's happening with, you know, culture within them, an identity within themselves. So, yeah, it was really kind of formative time. And I feel that that was a very lucky time that, you know, I joined a team of people, and they've all gone on and, you know, heading their own, you know, projects. And you could tell they were, you know what I mean? Because they were all that really kind of just rearing to just get their teeth into something, you know, creative and you know, have their own time to express themselves, you know?
I guess it's been that happens in, you know, traditional European-based restaurants, is you have those great restaurants, a great chef, people get drawn to it, and then they go off and open either clones or their other things. So I guess like having Dan Hong in that restaurant and having that Asian contingent in the kitchen kind of is the genesis of the way, you know, dining is being shaped in Sydney to Melbourne at the moment.
Yeah, correct. But then it's kind of like in, I feel that in like the Eurocentric European kind of model, that like you said, they either go off and go back to their hometowns and do something within their own kind of identity, or they open like a clone, right? You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, and we all know that, you know, two star, you know, cauliflower puree, see it's called a place that is anywhere, right? You know, you just sit in that restaurant and you could be like, I could be anywhere. You know what I mean? And there's like that, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. There's definitely a place in the market for that restaurant. But it's interesting to have that in like an Australian Asian context, because then, you know, there'd be a new wave of like Thai style restaurants, you know, activations, Malaysian Chinese, you know, new Chinese, you know, like Southeast Asian, and it just goes on and on. And it, I think it adds to the colorful fabric of the, you know, the dining scene of Australia, you know what I mean? Not just like, you know, one city. Does that make sense?
Were you part of the opening team at Mr. Wong?
Yeah.
Because like you go from Mark to Miss G's to Mr. Wong, two relatively small places to a pretty bloody big place. What was adapting to the volume like, and did it? I've never worked at such a high volume restaurant, so I'm just interested to know what team dynamics are like in a really high volume place, and also where and how you get the opportunity to inject your creativity into the food, or, you know, share some ideas and collaborate with the head chef and stuff. Like, what's the dynamic like, especially after having left two smaller venues?
I think, you know, it's all about the team, right? You know, the opening team of Mr. Wong's was amazing, you know, and a big part of it was from the incubator that was Miss G's, when they were collecting everybody to kind of see where everyone would fit, and the timing was probably right, you know what I mean? Like in Sydney at the time, to have, you know, a large kitchen and a large, you know, Asian-centric team, you know what I mean? Like, you got to think, before that, it was, if you were English-speaking, wanted to cook Asian food or Chinese food in particular, it's Billy Kwong and that's it. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, honestly, if you're CV building, that's it, right? And that back then, that was on the Crown Street location. Yeah. It was tiny, right? They would only let four people in there.
Yeah.
So to have the opportunity to explore Chinese food, where the kitchen team was, you know, communicating to you in English, was a very, very small market. Mm. But now, obviously, it's, you know, there's...
We've sort of spoken that before about how the acceptance of Asian food being more than just your local Chinese, and becoming something that is more refined and finer, has been a fairly recent uptake around the Western world, I guess. So it's just got something that it's taken a little while. So like you said, with timing, must just hit the right space, correct, where people
do you have any thoughts on why that was the case? Like, maybe we can explore a little bit about why, for the longest time, Chinese food in particular was, you know, bowling clubs to a lot of people, or, you know, local shops and things like that. And then, you know, as you said, Billy Kwong was your only option in Sydney, and then obviously down here you've got Flower Drum and others.
Yeah, but I think I don't know, I think it's because everyone has got a relationship with Chinese food, right? You know, your local suburban Chinese restaurant, you know, your local country town Chinese restaurant, everyone's got their, you know, especially, you know, it's like the second oldest culture, you know, migrant culture, you know, very large hubs, and, you know, established diaspora of, you know what I mean? So everyone's got their own relationship to Chinese food, and it's never been, unless you only eat at the Flower Drum, you know, you would never, you'd have a relationship or a preconceived idea of what this cuisine is, right? And from that. So it's, and for years it was, you know, sweet and sour pork and, you know, the satay beef, and people enjoyed it because it was still, you know, different enough to the day to day, but they still had a pretty clear established idea of what that was. So to enter the market and ask people to pay, you know, up to four times more what the entry level price is,
the value.
That's the value proposition, you know, for that type of cuisine. You need to be delivering something a little bit more than just what's on the plate. You know what I mean? So I think, and Mr. Wong's perfect for that, because it's just big, you know, massive, you know, designed, you know, like kind of escape reality little world of a restaurant.
I guess the dining room and the experience there adds value.
Yeah, correct.
Correct. So maybe that was an easing point for people to go, oh, I don't mind spending, you know, $25 on my fried rice there, because look where we're sitting. So I guess it kind of took that little nudge of that extra value add for a lot of people to want to spend that much money.
But it's do you think that's a little sad in a way, though, that, like, I mean, this runs parallel with all sorts of things, because you pay for the whole experience and things like that, but, like, you know, it takes Merivale and the grandiosity and the styling and the attention to detail at every turn to create an establishment like Wong to elevate the status of Chinese food.
Yeah, but I think it's a tricky one. I think it's definitely that, right? Like, you can see the value once you go into the place, right, and experience it. But, you know, I think a big thing that people don't realize is China's kind of interaction with the rest of the world via the internet is... It's like a wall, right? So no one can see in or out. So you don't know what's developing in China at the moment, because there isn't, you know, it's not flooding your feed, you know, via social media, but it's still, you know, kind of incubating a large, you know, part of the world's population on, you know, their own style, and you know, it's still business as usual in, you know, cities like Guangzhou, Beijing, Shanghai, and I think. In the West, because there isn't that kind of back and forth with a communication of development of design and style and culture, right, in kind of an artistic sense, you're stuck in like a weird time gap. You know what I mean? So like, if you open a Chinese restaurant, now, like everyone's designer would just be like chinoiserie, you know, like Red Lanterns, you know what I mean? Like pagodas, you know what I mean? Silk, gold, you know what I mean? Like, but then you go to, like I said, the hottest new restaurant that's open in Shanghai now, it just looks like a really sick modern restaurant, you know, not like some kind of 1950s throwback, you know, reimagined, you know what I mean?
So, so we're sort of seeing a historic view of, of what and people think.
Yeah, correct.
China
I think
is.
Everyone's stuck in like the 1950s idea of, you know, 1920s Shanghai, which is like, you go, that's 100 years old, right? Imagine imagine if you opened a modern Italian restaurant and you're like stuck in the concept of like, you know, 1918, like, you know, Naples. It's like, what's wrong with you? You know what I mean?
You can still find them.
Yeah, you can. But then, you know, the first thing they'll say is like, this thing's a little bit Mickey Mouse, right?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And, but then you wouldn't have that if it was, you know, and that's funny that, right? And I feel it's because there's like a bubble of, you know, like life online in China
that's
not being created, like not being communicated out into the West. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Never thought of it from that kind of lens.
Because honestly, like, did you know there's a Michelin guide for Guangzhou?
And yeah,
it's sick, right?
Yeah,
but then if you try and Google it, like the only you get one page in, and it's you can just get the information from the guide website, right?
Yeah, so
there isn't nothing else. There isn't like, you know, say for example, if you Google like, you know, Liho Fuku Mr. Wong's, there's like a million images from all the diners and stuff because it's out there. But then because China's internet's like an intranet, it's it's like a little walled pond. Mm. It doesn't really proliferate out. You know what I mean? So
I'm gonna just like think out loud for a second though. I guess like Australia is a European colonial country, and Chinese migration started happening, I believe, like, you know, the largest peak of early Chinese migration happened in the Gold Rush. And I don't know, considering it's a European colonial country, do you think that there's something about Chinese culture in Australia as compared to like European migration, which meant European migrants would more easily fit into the established dining culture, which is influenced by fine dining, France, you know, and the rest of it. And Chinese migration sort of sits outside of that and was established, you know, was established as that cheaper, faster option and just sitting outside it, which is sort of like there was this separation between European and Asian cuisine like every step of the way. And it's not until more recently that there's been, you know, a coalescence of those two cultures at a higher level of dining.
Yeah, look, like, I think it's always... It's always going to be Eurocentric because of just the, you know, the progression of history, right? And off that, you know, I think the Chinese restaurants established was always going to be like the low barrier of entry type, you know, hey, we'll just start a business and, you know what I mean? Like, we'll cook stuff, you know, some things we're familiar with, some things that the customers like, and then just trudge along and do that for, say, two generations. And then... I think we, in the last kind of 30 years, you'll see the kind of proliferation of like a layered type of regional Chinese cuisine. Like I remember when I, you know, like early 90s when we migrated here, it was just Cantonese restaurants, you know, and then it was, then it started like Shanghainese restaurants, and then you had like soup dumplings, you know what I mean? And then from there you get, you know, the Sichuan, Hunan, you know what I mean? And then you can now see there's specific regional Chinese restaurants like you would, like an Italian restaurant, you know, like when, before the 90s, it'd just be like an overarching Italian restaurant and they'd serve everything from pasta to pizza to whatever, right? And now you can really hone in on like, hey, you know, this is a Sicilian restaurant. They don't serve, you know, pizza, and they don't, you know, use butter. It's just olive oil. You know, we just, and then you go to like, hey, this is a Milanese restaurant, and they serve, you know, just that style of Italian food, which is very different to a Neapolitan. And people understand that because, you know, I think, you know, it's, and same with, I guess they're the, probably the two best examples.
Do you think people understand it though? Like, do you think Australians are good at understanding, you know, regional cuisine,
provincial cuisine? Yeah, it's
especially
tricky, right?
Chinese.
Yeah, it's tricky because they haven't traveled to these places. You know, and I feel that, you know, travel to Asia is more accessible for like, you know, the Australian person, right? So like having something like say Thai food and Northern Thai food, which is something that people understand now, right? So like Northern Thai food is going to be, you know, like herb heavy, acid, salt, you know, like funky. People can understand that because they've been there. You know what I mean? So I think it's that nuance, like it's all about just the exposure to that, right? And I think I feel it goes a little bit both ways. Like we're, it's kind of fueled by, you know, say the region-specific diaspora moving to Australia and starting food businesses, but also the Chinese students that come from that region seeking, you know, certain flavor profiles they really enjoy. And so
university campuses are a place, great place to eat.
Yeah, 100%. You know, honestly, like there's a really great kind of grill place from where I used to live, and it's just full of, you know, Chinese students, Balenciaga, and just eating like skewers. It's awesome.
Yeah.
But I think it's that. But then, you know, going back to the fine dining thing, I guess it's the acceptance to eat what a country deems as a delicacy, right? You know what I mean? Like, I think there's some good work done by, you know, kind of Chinese chefs or chefs with Chinese kind of heritage around the world in trying to put, you know, like abalone up, you know, in the forefront, or, you know what I mean? Like certain things that we'd consider as a delicacy. But it's also, it doesn't work if you go, hey, look, I'm just going to cook, you know, sea cucumber and fish more. And then you come in and you're like, what the fuck is this? Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, and it doesn't translate if you don't understand that this is, you know, of something of value. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Do you think, where do you think food media comes into educating the public about culture? Because I just sort of had the thought then that when we're talking about people understanding regional cuisine, it seems to me, and in some of the first bits of understanding that I got, is like when a fine dining establishment or a well-respected chef or whatever it might be opens a region-specific place and the food media latches onto that, yet, you know, you can already find great Sichuan places in Chinatown, but it's not until someone, you know, at the caliber of yourself, or I specifically think about Josiah Lee in Canberra with Chairman and Yip Malame and some of his other restaurants where he did Chinese food at a very high level and very regionally specific as well. And that's like, that's what sort of educated the public in Canberra. They're like, okay, we're going to go to a Sichuan or a Cantonese specific place and stuff. But yeah, like it just, I guess like food media follows people with profile and follows a higher level of dining a lot of the time. And yeah, it sort of might take the influence of someone.
There hasn't been Asian faces that media have been following until, you know, fairly recently. So I guess it comes down to, they put, you know, like there's a lot of conversations now about representation in media, and that's just important.
100%. I think that's all it is. It's just the variety of voices, right? Mm. Like if you can get a big range of people talking about a big range of things, it'll just kind of like naturally fall into, you know, because if, you know, for example, it doesn't even have to be Chinese. If say, you know, if if you know Southern Senegalese food is awesome, like guess what, like it's going to be the next, like it's you know, all you got to do is point people to it, and you know, like they'll vote with, you know, like the economics of patronage, right? You know, so
have you seen what Dan Barber's doing at Blue Hill at Stone Barns with his like intern chefs?
Yes,
that's amazing, that stuff.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's all that kind of stuff, right? It's just giving people opportunity to just have a crack at it, right?
Yeah.
And then the right people have to be the gatekeeper, you know. I feel that that's the key, or not even have a gatekeeper, you know what I mean? Like and I think it's I think everyone who can communicate anything to a big group of people or a small group of people has a responsibility of driving it a certain way, right? And I think the overall idea would be improving, you know, as opposed to like in the conservationist lens, you know what I mean? Especially in a country like Australia. I feel like if everyone was slightly skewed towards being an innovator and less being, you know, a conservationist in terms of culture, art and the ideal, that'd be pretty cool.
What with sort of all these things in mind, how did you go about putting this restaurant together? Like how much thought process was to history, to kind of innovation, to you know, modernizing a concept? Like what kind of things did you do to research your heritage to kind of create this restaurant?
Yeah, I think, look, a big range of it comes from inspiration and trying to communicate sometimes even a flavor or a dish forward, you know, to fit within like the tasting menu at current. But
yeah,
the latest kind of place that I'm looking at is kind of the Australian history. You know, what does an Australian Chinese experience feel like? How does an Australian kind of producer or winemaker kind of story look like fit into a Chinese restaurant? You know, I've obsessed with the idea of not being a Chinese restaurant in Melbourne, but more like a Melbourne restaurant that serves Chinese food. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I feel like with that kind of lens, I bring a slightly more kind of inclusive philosophy, you know, because then it means that, hey, you know, all you got to, if you're, you know, Australia-centric, you know, producer, grower, whatever, then you already will have, you know, like I'll already look at you in terms of an area of exploration. So I'm not really that obsessed with trying to manipulate something that I think is cool or interesting in a Chinese context. I'd rather look at it in an Australian context and include, you know, elements that I find interesting from Chinese cuisine or heritage or history. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, like straight away, if you're in a different country doing a different country's food, your ingredients different.
Yes.
You know, how they're grown, the climate, the soil, the temperature, especially Australia, when it's got quite unique soils and a fucking crazy climate at times. So, I mean, straight away, you're going to be doing things a little bit different. And that's always going to put your food in a sort of Australian context.
There's something that I wanted to ask before that I'll quickly go back to, but it's a part of what Simon's question was, but how did sort of moving away from what you learned at Mr. Wong and what you were doing with Dan Hong up there, you know, like how did you avoid being labeled as like a Melbourne replica essentially?
Yeah, I think, you know, Dan, the food at Mr. Wong's is, you know, kind of like a reworked classic or almost identical classic, just done with, you know, amazing produce and slight refinement, you know what I mean? And it reflects in their style. So you can, I feel like that's slightly more traditional, you know, representation of what a Cantonese restaurant offering is. But the style of food that we create here is more like taking elements of a dish and creating it in a certain, in a style and context that would fit in what we're trying to express. So, you know, using flavor profiles and you know, not really exploring the idea of authenticity and making it kind of delicious in its own setting. You know, I always think that, like, everyone's always obsessed with the idea of authenticity when I think it's bullshit, right? Like, you go to some regional areas and you taste the food and you go, yep, I get it. This is where black vinegar's from, but do you have to put it on everything?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And just because you know, recreate that dish in its authentic state does not mean that the dish is balanced or good. You know what I mean? Like, we always joke in the kitchen, like, do you want to make good food or you want to make authentic food, right?
Yeah. And
so it's, you know, and as a job of someone that can manipulate it to taste a certain way or better or in your, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't mean that I'm messing with it or I'm fusing it with anything. I'm just trying to make it so that it fits in a setting that, you know, and especially like going back to your first question, how much of the stuff do you consider? Everything. So I consider how the customer would eat that, how big the portion is, what's the wine that they're going to drink with that. And, you know, and they're all things that we all think about and collectively as a team. And that in itself is like an interesting exploration and exercise for us, but it's just part of the process that we, you know, create stuff here.
How do you continue to find inspiration to continue to develop new dishes and that fit within the evolution of this restaurant?
Well, I'm lucky because I've got a core team that's very good, right? And they've all worked for me for a substantial amount of time to know the style that I'm after. And it's also, they've got, like, I trust them to present me ideas and concepts where, and sometimes it needs very little tweaking. Sometimes it needs, like, a lot of work. So that process is fun. So now it feels like I don't have to be this, you know, all-encompassing kind of dictator of the style or, you know what I mean? Like, I've got other lenses to look at the food through, you know? So
when you have sort of keen young chefs, they're really good because they'll be like you were sort of 10 years ago. They'll be reading all the new books. They'll always be like, I just bought this from my, I didn't even realize that came out yet. They'll be on Instagram and they'll be coming with like the new techniques, the new plating.
Yeah, correct.
So it's good having those little kind of underlings who are just kind of constantly bringing you stuff. So you haven't got to quite stay so on top all the time. And then it is, you know, about helping them develop it and getting something that they've helped create on the plate, which, I mean, keeps your staff very engaged.
Yeah, look, it's a lot of that. But also, you know, because we're so process driven with everything here, you know, in terms of how it looks, feels, tastes, where's it from, what's the reference, you know, like, we're always trying to, like, innovate on something that's older or newer or even, like, you know, having the restaurant for 8 years, the repertoire is pretty big, right? Yeah. So, like, it could just be retweaking one thing or there's a lot of failures on the board as well. And, you know, like, there could be something that's popped up and they go, oh, this is the solution to fix that thing that you really like but didn't quite work before. So it's a lot of kind of loop back into that, you know, and exploring it that way is quite fun too, because once that little piece unlocks, it unlocks another thing. Because, like, you know, with everything, you can just take a note on everything now, right? So, like, my notes app is got, it looks like I'm on crack, right? You know? And same with, you know, the Evernote, and you can share it with everybody. You know what I mean? Like, you can flag stuff on Instagram, you know, tell people to look in certain directions. So there's a lot of just stuff in the ether floating around. The hard part is trying to focus the energy on creating, and you know what I mean? We're not short of, like, where do all these ideas come from? We're short of, like, where do we, like, slot things in and how much energy do you devote to one thing, you know?
And you go back to things, like, there's even some, like, failures that you can sometimes take and be like, oh, that didn't make what I wanted at the time, but that might actually be cool there. So that's one thing I'm always trying to get onto young chefs. Like, I kind of want you on your phone in the kitchen. Like, I want you taking notes, I want you taking pictures, I want you dictating to it. Like, I want you on Instagram, like, finding out this stuff. Like, I kind of want my young chefs to be on their phone in the kitchen. Which is kind of a bit of a stranger from the older guard who'd give you shit for having your phone out.
But it's really cool, right? Like, if young chefs are sort of taking the initiative to, you know, plate things a different way or add ingredients or do some experimentation, like, in their break time and document that stuff on their phone and, like, build that, you know, like, encyclopedia notebook of experience and little processes and things like that they've played with. It shows they're the ones you kind of want because
they're going
above and beyond.
Yeah,
really,
they're the guys you can sort of see, like, you'll be good in the future. Like, there is a balance. You get some chefs who that's all they want to do.
Yeah, true. But they don't want to cook. I feel like, you know, like, creativity, you can train that, right? But a big part of it is telling people, no, that's not good enough. Or that doesn't work. Because, you know, like, the last thing I want them to do is, you know, open their own restaurants and think that all their ideas are king shit, right? You want them to be like, actually, no. You know, and a few of those doesn't hurt, you know, someone's creative process, because, you know, they could fight my judgment on that and create something better or just go back to the drawing board and tweak stuff. You know what I mean? Like, I feel that that's a huge part of the process.
Yeah. I mean, I think, like, a lot of time what you take off your original idea from a dish is one of the most important decisions you make when you go, it doesn't need that. Or, like, what is that doing? What's the function of that? That flavor on the plate, like, what's that adding to it? Like, a lot of time young chefs chuck as much technique and stuff.
All right, well, Like, let's start wrapping it up. And it was another thing that we were sort of talking a bit about before we started, but you're exec chef across three venues, Chooka's up in Sydney, you're here. Are you still on the pans a lot? Are you still in the...
I wish I could say I was, eh? Yeah. You know, like, honestly, this year is the one that I haven't been in the kitchen as much.
Mm. How's that?
Yeah, look, I think you're not prepared to, like, just jump off it, right? You know, but unfortunately this year there isn't a spot for me in the kitchen. You know what I mean? Like, so it's you do feel a little bit rusty when you have to jump back in there.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's, I do really miss, like, the style of work when you work in a kitchen, because, you know, you're focused on one task and you have to do it, and it's quite physical because, you know, could we say something as simple as, like, cutting carrots, right? Like, everyone says cutting carrots, but when's the last time you cut a carrot? No one cuts carrots. You know, like, you know what I mean? You're like, oh, yeah. chopping onions. Like, man, I haven't cut an onion in ages. But, like, even when I was cooking, I haven't cut an onion in ages. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's always something like, you know, say, for example, filleting fish or doing something like that, you need a little bit of pace a little bit of focus, and, you know, it's just you, the clock. And
Simon was bragging the other day about how... were you breaking down?
I had 12 barramundis for this event I did. And they came in, and I was like, right, I'm going to do them in an hour. So they were gutted and scaled. I just took them down. But I love that, like, racing yourself.
Yeah, correct.
Like, that repetition of, like, and even just being like, oh, these barriers, like, the rib cage coming up a bit higher. Like, so next one I'll get up there. Oh, that's much better, that one. Like, oh, fuck, I'm sure the fucking apprentice is that. Like, sorry, I'm moving my mic around. Like,
so, yeah. So I really miss that, right? Mm. You know, that there's it's task-oriented, it's time pressure. I think my workday now is more... like intellectual, you know, you know, like, for example, come up with recipes to train the staff tomorrow at Marvel. You know, a big part of it's communicating my actual ideas in and the nuances of the style of food that I want to do, you know, to a range of different personalities and, you know, temperaments and, you know, conditions of work. And then I'm working on the floor a little bit here at Li Ho Fook, you know, because just want to learn. It was the steepest learning curve, and I thought, you know what, it's something that has always given me, like, quite a lot of anxiety, like facing the customer.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just thought, you know what, if I'm going to change it, I want to be able to communicate why. With, you know what I mean? So yeah, it's been good, like in that setting. But it's also it's challenging, and it's a different kind of challenging.
I find this, like, I like doing services now because it feels safe. Like,
yeah, well, I think the kitchen's an easy place to run away to, right? But then when you're customer facing on the floor, you just have to sit there and, well, like,
I like it because, like, I spend the whole day on the phone or sending emails or writing notes or writing something to pin to the wall because the chefs have been fucking up something. And I'm like, right, it's going on the wall, like, stick it up there. And then it gets to, like, 5 o'clock and I'm like, right, no one's going to email or call me now. Yeah. And I can just get back in the kitchen for a couple of hours and no one's going to fucking bother me except the customers.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've actually been in the kitchen, but just having a finite length of time it takes you to do something is really nice.
That's like, because at the moment it's perpetual, right? Yeah. They're like, when are you going to send that cocktail recipe, Victor? And I'm like, at some stage this week, and all of a sudden that gives me a timeline from now until midnight Sunday.
Yeah,
right?
Totally. You know,
at some stage this week,
11:30,
and then all of a sudden, and then all of a sudden, like, where's that bloody margarita recipe?
Yeah,
you know, and or like when they call, like when, you know, I'm on the phones, and then, like, you stumble something, you leave a note, and you don't follow it up, and then
I'm just constantly apologizing to people. I think it's recipes off. I'm like,
I do miss that. I miss that regimented, you know, that when to start, when to finish, and it's impossible for you to go past that because otherwise it's, you know, doom and despair.
It's an interesting, like, I don't know, I feel like a lot of trades, like, have that sort of similar career path, but I think that the change, you know, to go from an apprentice chef, you know, just slogging it out, you might be picking herbs for a long time and then chopping onions. You graduate to chopping onions. But to go to a point where you're then, like, you know, as a head chef, your hands are, like, in the kitchen, like, you know, making decisions, leading a team and stuff, but then, you know, opening your own venue or being an exec, and then all of a sudden you're not in the kitchen anymore. You spent so much time in that place.
Yeah, you do have, like, I mean, 10, 15, 20 years of just, like, hard graft in the kitchen, and quite quickly, as you just take a next step, whether you're opening or you get an executive chef role, suddenly you're expected to know how to do spreadsheets.
Yeah, correct.
And how I think to there should be, and like,
yeah, I wonder about that, right? You know, because I talk to a lot of other chefs that are in a similar situation, and it's, I think they always say it's the trickiest part, because it feels like you should be mentored here again, you know, to be taught how to, you know, like segment your time a little bit, you know what I mean? It's kind of like, I feel like there's a lot of people in my situation, but no one's taught us how to do any of this, right?
So,
but then if I sit there and I delegate it all to my current staff, they're like probably a little bit overworked, you know what I mean?
And then
it's like, well, what am I doing then?
You know what I mean?
I could easily go, hey, you know, my ops manager, hey, give me the recipes for this, send me the workflow for that, go to my head chef and go, hey, you know, dig up the recipes for this and then send it all to me in this email.
But I mean, as a chef, you're just not used to doing that either.
No, like, correct.
That's not the way you work.
Yeah, you want to do end to end, right?
Yeah.
Like, where is that? And then you'd like check it. I think this recipe was too sweet last time. Let's drop
that.
You know, like.
Yeah, I mean, where other businesses, like, you know, people have PAs and assistants and all these things, and it is like, you know, whenever I go to like law firm and they're just like, everything's on the secretary. It's like, can you just do all this shit for me and bring it to me?
Yeah,
but I just sit there and I'm like, oh, that's, imagine that. That's good.
I think, like, I might speak to a partner in the law firm. How did you?
Well, I think that's kind of what I've been looking to, is like, look into those industries and seeing how they work their time, how they like plan, like even like how does this calendar app work so I can keep track of stuff. Like, something I've been really kind of looking to get better at is, because again, like I said, no one teaches you.
Yeah, because otherwise what happens is then you start like just doing shit on your downtime, right? Because you're like, you feel so guilty that you're not effective.
You know?
So you just sit there 100%. And go, all right, look, you know, I'll smash this out. And you're like, oh, where did my day off go? Like,
Well, these deadlines, like, I always like, I'm sure other people let emails go for ages, because I know I never get replies, but I'm always like, oh shit, I gotta reply to that, better do it. Like, oh, it's 1:30 in the morning. Still, I'll just do it now. I'll just knock it out. Let's get it done. Otherwise, it'll be late. Like, I said, I'll email him. Like, you're always kind of, it's weird, like, chef mode you get put in after 15 years of regimented cooking. And you get put out and you're like, I'm not a real human.
Cool. Well, let's wrap it up. Victor, is there anything else? Like, you sort of happy and optimistic about how everything's going at the moment? Like, is there any new things coming up you want to make us aware of, or any ideas that you've got that you're looking to pursue?
No, nothing. I think it's just slowly rebuilding. You know, I think it'd be nice if everyone visited Melbourne.
Yeah,
you know, we're ready to have you.
I know, man. We're so happy.
We've been pumping the stories on Instagram.
We've been trying to get down here for so long. Like, we've had two trips booked and cancelled.
Yeah, and I think that's probably what it is as well. With in terms of interstate travel, there's a lot of people that have, you know, like, kind of stung by the idea of like a cancelled trip.
Yeah,
and it's not so much a monetary thing. It's just like, the anguish and the heartbreak of like not being able to go. Well, so
even a couple of times where borders reopened, people went and then borders closed. And it was
that's
back.
Right.
Like, that's still a bit of a worry.
Like, we're never fucking doing that again.
But I think in the next couple of months, I know we're Bangalore sort of targeting people from Victoria coming over as customers coming up. So I imagine it'll be the same going this way. So hopefully it'll be a bit of exchange program.
And there's some really cool stuff happening in Melbourne at the moment.
Yeah, I want to see more anchovy on toast in Sydney. We don't have enough of it. It's everywhere here.
It's true.
It's We've had anchovy on toast at everywhere we've eaten so
it's
far.
Delicious.
It's delicious.
So hopefully that can come Sydney side.
We've got plenty.
Get it at Bangalore next week.
Yeah, I know. Put it on, mate. Put it on. Victor, mate, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Pleasure to meet you, and it's fantastic being here in Melbourne. Everyone, come to Melbourne.
Yeah.
Come to Melbourne, and like, good, I mean, dinner. Out of any state that needs support, it's Victoria. You know, like, 100%. And so come, Victor. Thank you so much, mate.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much,
thanks, mate.
Cheers.
Hello, dear listeners. Steph here. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of The Food Fight. If you want to get in touch with us, it's at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram or thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com. We want to hear from you and we want to talk to you. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps. If you want to hit me up, it's quicksandfood.com or at quicksandfood on Instagram. And if you want to get in touch with Simon, it's Simon_Evans_TBD on Instagram. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll catch you again with another episode.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.